This is VOA News, reporting by remote. I'm Joe Ramsey. A top Miami-Dade County fire official Saturday told family members of people missing in the rubble of a collapsed condo tower. Demolition workers plan to bring down the remainder of the building on Sunday. Worries have intensified over the past week. The damaged structure could come tumbling down on its own, endangering the crews below and complicating the search for victims. The approach of Hurricane Elsa from the Caribbean Sea also raises concerns that strong winds possible in South Florida by late Sunday or early Monday could further destabilize the standing portion of the towers. The confirmed death toll from the June 24th collapse stands at 22 Saturday. Officials reduced the number of missing from 145 to 126 after duplicate names were eliminated and some residents reported missing turned up safe. The Canadian military says it's on standby Saturday to help evacuate towns and fight more than 170 wildfires fueled by a record-setting heat wave and tinder dry conditions a day after the government in Ottawa warned of a, quote, long and challenging summer ahead. At least 177 fires are active in western British Columbia, 76 of them sparked in the last 2 days, according to fire officials. Most were caused by intense lightning storms 350 kilometers or 220 miles northeast of Vancouver. A British Columbia Wildlife Service official told public broadcaster CBC there were about 12,000 lightning strikes on Friday. Roughly 1,000 people have fled the wildfires in British Columbia, with many others still missing. The British Columbia Medical Examiner's Office late Friday said there'd been 719 deaths in the past week, three times more than the average number recorded over the period. This is VOA News. A Syrian war monitoring group says seven children were among nine civilians killed by regime artillery fire on Saturday in Syria's last major rebel stronghold of Idlib in the country's northwest. The shelling also wounded around 15 others, according to the Syria Observatory for Human Rights. Saturday's death toll is one of the highest since an international ceasefire came into force in March 2020, but there are frequent violations of the truce brokered by regime ally Russia and rebel-backed Turkey. Russian warplanes have pounded the southern Idlib region over the past weeks in tandem with artillery shelling by regime forces, according to the monitor. The war in Syria has killed nearly 500,000 people since it started in 2011 with the brutal repression of peaceful demonstrations. Afghan officials Saturday claimed hundreds of Taliban fighters have been killed in battles with government forces across several areas of Afghanistan, as Washington announced it would finish withdrawing its troops from the country by the end of August. All U.S. and NATO troops Friday vacated their main Bagram air base, from where the coalition forces led operations for two decades against Taliban and Al-Qaeda allies. The Afghan Ministry of Defense said Saturday over the past 24 hours, more than 300 Taliban fighters were killed in fighting with government forces, including many in airstrikes. There have been fears that Afghan forces would struggle without the air support that the United States has provided. The Taliban rejects the government's claims. Both sides often exaggerate each other's casualties, and their claims are difficult to independently verify. But since May 1st, when the U.S. military began its final withdrawal of about 2,500 troops, the two warring sides have clashed fiercely across the rugged countryside as peace talks between them have faltered. Thousands of people took to the streets of Burkina Faso on Saturday, demanding a stronger response to rising jihadist bloodshed after a massacre last month killed more than 130 people. The landlocked West African country has faced increasing attacks by jihadist groups linked to Al-Qaeda or the Islamic State since 2015. It was the first march organized by the opposition and civil society groups since President Roch Marc Christian Kabore was reelected last year. Burkina Faso's president had asked the organizers to postpone the march, but the country's opposition leader welcomed, quote, a huge mobilization across the country despite government calls for a boycott. He claims during Kabore's first term, there were officially more than 1,300 deaths and 1.2 million internally displaced people. He says he fears the second term will be worse than the first because since the start of the year, he claims there's been more than 300 deaths. Reporting by remote, I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
I used to love what he would say at the end. He'd say, the interpretation of that commandment is that you should do unto your fellow citizens as you'd have them do unto you. And I think that's the greatest lesson that he has left with us.
African leaders pay glowing tribute to Zambia's founding president, Dr. Kenneth David Kaunda, Friday.
We moved from a motion court into incarceration without a trial in between. What kind of justice system is that? Other than the fact that this is a whole a political conspiracy that is meant to just plunge the man because of what he stands for.
Former South African President Jacob Zuma files a petition to the Constitutional Court. It asks the court to review and rescind a previous ruling that imposes a 15-month jail time.
For starters, we fully and wholeheartedly condemn the violence that has been perpetrated by the king against an unarmed and peacefully protesting people of Swaziland that are claiming and are calling for their rights to be respected.
And the African Union condemns violent protests in the southern African kingdom of Eswatini. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The state funeral of Dr. Kenneth David Kaunda, founding president of Zambia, was held in the capital Lusaka Friday. Several African heads of state who attended the service paid glowing tribute to the deceased leader as they paid their last respects. Until his death last month, Dr. Kaunda was the only surviving African leader who fought colonial rule and became the country's first president. He led Zambia to gain independence from former colonial power Britain in 1964. Dr. Kaunda, affectionately called KK, died last month from pneumonia. He was 97. Zambia mourners held and waved white handkerchiefs in memory of the former president, whose trademark symbol was a white handkerchief. For reaction from Dr. Kaunda's family about the state funeral, I reached Tilyenji Kaunda, son of the former Zambian president.
Well, I must say that we've been grateful for the outpour sympathy from the Zambians themselves and also from dad's friends from beyond our borders. It's really been something that has helped us in our moment of grief. You know, in our African tradition, when someone dies, then people gather at the funeral house in huge numbers sometimes, you know. Unfortunately, the COVID-19 thing has not allowed us to gather as we would have liked to gather as a family. But I think that these days with social media, it has been possible to reach people in the far corners of the world. And we found comfort in that.
Several heads of state and government officials from around the world are currently in Zambia to mourn with you as they celebrate the life of your father. From the family's perspective, how are you taking this? And especially when some Zambians are saying that you now share your father, or you have always shared your father, with the entire country and by extension Africa as a whole.
We didn't realize just how big my dad was until the message from leaders in that country started sending in the messages of condolence. And also their physical presence here is also a bit overwhelming, and we're thankful for that. And I must say, we also received a special messenger from the Queen to deliver a message of condolence. So all that has made us realize that my dad achieved more than we thought he actually had. And this being so because he's been now out of power since 1991 and away from politics since 2000. So we are seeing dad somewhat in a new light. From the Zambians, it's been amazing because from little girls who are just, you know, 5 years old, his name is on their lips. And there are young people, adults, who were born after he left power who are analyzing and going through his life. So it's quite an experience. It's like rediscovering your dad, you know. And I must say, he did say some time back, as he was giving us the book, Letter to My Children, he said, I've written this book to you, for you, but this book is for all Zambians, all my children out there. All Zambians are my kids. I think that we should forgive one another and move on.
What major lesson do you think Zambians should take as they bid farewell to their founding father and your father?
I think that a final lesson would be this. Peace requires eternal vigilance. So we need to remember the verses that we would quote from the Bible, which is that you should love your God with all your heart, all your mind, all your soul, and all your strength. And he would say that's the first commandment. And then he would say the second is like, love your neighbor as thyself. I think that was his biggest lesson. So we've seen strife across our continent, where sometimes there are only two tribes existing or two groupings existing, and they begin killing one another. So we need to have that as our foundation and concept on our minds, that let's exercise love. And I used to love what he would say at the end. He would say, the interpretation of that commandment is that you should do unto your fellow citizens as you'd have them do unto you. And I think that's the greatest lesson that he has left with us.
Tilienji Kaunda is the son of Zambia's founding president, Dr. Kenneth David Kaunda. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. Meanwhile, in Zambia, the opposition United Party for National Development, or UPND Alliance, is welcoming as a positive step the ban imposed on Dr. Chishimba Kambwili, a member of the governing Patriotic Front, or PF. The Electoral Commission of Zambia imposed the ban on Kambwili for hate speech. The sanction prevents him from campaigning for incumbent President Edgar Lungu and his governing PF in the run-up to the August 12 general election. But the opposition alliance said the restriction did not go far enough. They want the Electoral Commission to ban the governing party from campaigning, arguing that top officials of the group have been aware yet failed to take action to stop Kambwili's offensive pronouncement at the party's campaign rallies. Thabo Kawana is a spokesperson for the Zambian main opposition UPND alliance. He tells me that the electoral body must ensure political parties are banned if any of their members engage in hate speech ahead of the election. This, Kawana says, will ensure the country remains peaceful during the election process.
Well, of course, we are delighted with the decision taken by the Electoral Commission of Zambia, although we feel that they could have gone a step further, because he is campaigning for a named political party, and he's doing his campaigns in the name of the political party and in the name of the president. Therefore, he is a fully-fledged member of that political party, and he is a founder member. So the liability must accrue to the political party, not necessarily to him as an individual. So we feel that the ECZ should have gone a step further to ban the political party itself because of them allowing him to continue using hate speech to campaign for them. Because if the party was not liable, the party would have taken the step before ECZ by ensuring that they stop him. They even withdraw him from the campaign.
Yeah, but Thabo, you went ahead to report him to the police, citing this very hate speech. Some people are saying it's a step too far, and the police do not necessarily have the power to prosecute him.
That is a layman's argument. The hate speech is provided for in the laws of Zambia, and it is a criminal offense. It is prosecutable, and one is liable to imprisonment. And that is why when you go and report to the police have to take action in accordance with the law. So you cannot have an individual who continues to talk ill about a group of people in the country with impunity. This is how other foreign nations have ended up in turmoil, because of leaving individuals to talk carelessly like he is. So we must avert any future calamities by ensuring that that hate speech he's spewing is not allowed to take its course in the country. We stop him in his tracks.
some supporters of the Patriotic Front that I spoke with are of the opinion that because Dr. Chisemba Kambule has been so effective and nullified all your attacking points, policies you are expounding, that is why the UPND is hot and trying to bring him down. And they said it is unfortunate that the Electoral Commission of Zambia will take such a decision to ban him from campaigning. How do you respond to that?
Preposterous. There's nothing that he is attacking. This is a gentleman that is going to the public and telling the public that your lives are expensive because the UN has said the whole world, the cost of living is high. And even in London, the cost of millimeter is like this. And you're not giving those kind of economic parameters that don't even make sense. They have nothing to tell the people. And that is why he has resorted going tribal, going hate speech, because he has nothing tangible to tell the people. This is a gentleman who not too long ago had so much spew and baggage to talk about the Patriotic Front. He insulted them day and night, and now he's back with them, and he doesn't know how to campaign for them. The best is for him to try and spew hatred towards us as a political party and towards the Tonga-speaking people in Zambia.
Thabo, some people are saying what Dr. Kambule said about the UPND, that it is predominantly dominated by Tonga people, is accurate, and that it is unfortunate that the UPND does not want to face up to the truth, and that is why you have been trying to silence him. Your response to that?
It is not true that it is predominant by Tonga-speaking people. UPND is a party with a national character. Tonga-speaking people only exist in the southern part of the country, but we're in all provinces of the country. Myself, I'm not from southern province, I'm from western province. Alliance partners are even from northern province. Our vice president is from northern province. The president himself is from southern province. The party chairperson is from another province. So how can they say we are dominated by southern province? It is because southern province is among our strongholds, which historically was a stronghold because the party was literally born from there. But today, we don't have a specific stronghold. The entire country is a stronghold. And that is why we are winning these elections. And that is what is hurting them. Because everywhere Hakainde goes, the people react because they now feel it is time for change and they have accepted him. And all that tribal garbage and nonsense that they were throwing on him, the people of Zambia have said, enough, we no longer believe in this. This is a true son of the soul, and we are all part of the party. And it has a national character, and that is why it is winning this election.
Thabo Kawana is a spokesperson for the Zambian main opposition UPND Alliance. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. In South Africa, former President Jacob Zuma has filed a petition to the Constitutional Court. He asked the court to review and rescind a previous ruling that imposed a 15-month jail time on the country's former leader. Mr. Zuma was scheduled to hand himself over to the police to begin a 15-month jail sentence beginning Sunday. Citing contempt, the Constitutional Court ordered the former president to serve 15 months jail time for refusing to be part of an inquiry commission investigating graft during his time as South Africa's president. But supporters of Mr. Zuma have rejected the court's ruling, saying it is yet another example of the persecution of the former president. They also say allegations of corruption being investigated by the anti-graft commission are politically motivated. Meanwhile, supporters from the Nkonto Wesizwe Military Veterans Association warned the ruling African National Congress that there would be dire consequences if the former president is jailed. Nzwane Lemanyi is the spokesperson for the Jacob Zuma Foundation. He tells me that lawyers for the former president are working out legal options available to him. His supporters deny that Mr. Zuma is behaving as if he was above the law, and he rejects the court's ruling as unconstitutional and an affront to fairness.
The basic disquiet in this whole thing has really been a disagreement between President Zuma and the Deputy Chief Justice. And the root cause of the problem is simply that President Zuma believed that because of their past history, the Deputy Chief Justice will not be neutral in giving President Zuma audience as a participant in the commission. Now, the Deputy Chief Justice had a different view that no, that can be the issue. And he submitted, he proposed an affidavit to that effect. So now what we then have is two affidavits. President Zuma's affidavit saying our friendship, our background takes away your objectivity and neutrality. And Tenije Zondo putting his own affidavit on the table saying, no, there's no such a thing. Whatever relationship we had in the past cannot be elevated to make me lose neutrality.
But others are also saying that the former president appeared to elevate himself above the law and that he felt too big to subject himself to the commission that has powers to investigate state capture. And that is why he's in the position he is in now. How do you respond to that?
There is no truth that he thinks is above the law. He subjected himself to processes. And when that did not work, he again followed processes in terms of going to court to submit his application for the province. All of that means this is a person who is putting faith and confidence in the legal system of the country, which now has failed. The Constitutional Court, now here are the issues that show that the legal system is not favoring President Zuma and without being very objective. Firstly, the Constitutional Court, the highest court in the land, has turned down numerous applications of direct access, even when life was involved, even when people were murdered. We've got, I can give you an example, one Cossack guy at Alexandra here was murdered by the soldiers. When that case was brought to the Constitutional Court, it was thrown out and sent back to the High Court. But when they get an application of a contempt of court for some reason, then they accept this, then they give direct access. And in fact, Deputy Chief Justice Zondo has been to the Constitutional Court at least twice in about 2 months, a place where others, when they go there with serious cases, they sometimes take 6 months to get access, and when they get there, they get checked out. That's the first thing. Then the next thing, in terms of the emotion and everything, the first thing that President Zuma's point is making is that if you have the Constitutional Court judges in their own judgment, they are saying that President Zuma has been insulting the court and all of that. So in other words, you are sitting here with an angry panel of judges that think that their institution has been attacked. So what that means is that you are now having a case adjudicated by an aggrieved panel because they think that you're undermining their institution.
The court has ordered the president to submit himself on Sunday lunchtime, South African time. Is he going to abide by the ruling, if I may ask you?
The lawyers are working on that whole issue and they'll advise what is the right way to do. At this point, they are still busy with it. There is no decision on that matter as far as that's concerned.
What is the former president's reaction to this? Because some of his supporters are saying these are politically motivated. Others are saying, no, it's due process and he's having his day and that this is the process that has to be carried out. It's being carried out transparently. How do you respond to that?
In South Africa, in apartheid days, we had something that was called detention without trial. Now in a democracy, we've got incarceration without trial. We've got imprisonment without trial. Now, what kind of democracy is that, where a person gets imprisoned without trial? This is what it is. The civil case, we moved from a motion court into incarceration without a trial in between. What kind of justice system is that, other than the fact that this is a whole a political conspiracy that is meant to just plunge the man because of what he stands for? That is the problem. There is no objective evidence to show that justice is being carried out here. It just has an agenda that is being pushed by hook or by crook.
Izwanele Manyi is the spokesperson for the Jacob Zuma Foundation. He spoke with me from Johannesburg, South Africa. The African Union has sharply condemned the violence in Eswatini that has left at least 9 people dead and many more injured. This as pro-democracy activists, students and supporters of banned political groups demand more democratic reforms. They want the removal of the king to pave way to choosing their own leaders. The protest came after the government banned protesters from presenting petitions to parliamentarians. Supporters of the government say leaders have banned political parties, including the Swaziland People's Liberation Movement. They accuse the groups of fomenting trouble to destabilize the country and violently remove the king, charges the groups deny. Vusi Shongwe is the exiled leader of the Swaziland People's Liberation Movement. He tells me that the international community should pressure the authorities in Eswatini to allow citizens to elect their own leaders like in any democracy.
This protest that we are seeing is a cry for help by the people of Swaziland, and it's also a cry to say enough is enough. After more than 40 years of oppression by the royal family in what we have since termed the longest state of emergency since the 1973 decree when political parties and multi-party democracy was banned in Swaziland. It's been years of the people of Swaziland crying for the country to be returned to multi-party democracy. So the protests are a culmination of all these years of work for the people to say enough is enough, we want to return to multi-party democracy.
But Vusi, some supporters of the government and the monarch are of the view that people like you, pro-democracy groups like you in exile, are pushing this to undermine the country's territorial integrity, create chaos, and try to force democratic reforms by throwing out the monarchy. What do you say to that?
Peter, it's an undeniable fact, and history is the best teacher, to the fact that all regimes and all dictators the world over, they never want to cede power to the people, particularly if they've been in power for many, many years, ruling with an iron fist and things like that. That is the same sentiment that King Mswati is sharing, and it's the same sentiment that King Mswati has been ruling that country for more than 45 years, as I've just mentioned earlier. For starters, this regime is now illegitimate. It has lost all moral compass and moral ground and legitimacy to be calling itself the government of Swaziland, following the indiscriminate killing of people that we have observed in the last 72 hours in the country in this protest. So they've lost all legitimacy.
But Vusi, the king once said that Swazis believe in monarchical democracy, and that is what is being practiced. People like it. The constitution says political parties are not allowed in the kingdom to participate in elections, and Swazis or people of Eswatini have abided by this for all this time. What changed?
What I can say is that they are universally accepted standards that needs to be adhered to for any country to be declared to be a democratic country, and following these universal standards of democracy, the rule of law, and the will of the people. So on the issue of King Mswati going around and to the international community to say people are happy with this, we need to understand, as we've always said, that in Swaziland we didn't have a platform where people can willingly and freely organize along party lines and then put across how they want to be ruled. Everything that has been happening in the country, it has been happening on the terms and the conditions of the king so that he can entrench and continue to rule that country by the iron fist.
Vusi, your party, which is banned in Eswatini, is blamed for calling on the international community to pressure the kingdom for more democratic reforms and inviting people to accept the power structure as it is in Eswatini at the moment. Basically calling on the international community to interfere with the internal political dynamics in the kingdom. And that is unpatriotic and treasonous. How do you respond to that?
What we are saying as the people of Swaziland, we're saying the time is now for us to self-determine. The time is now for us to be released from the evil claws of the king and his family that have been self-enriching and plundering the country into absolute poverty because of their huge, unquenchable appetite for luxury and all of those things. So it's not an issue of being unpatriotic and things like that, but these are internationally accepted and fundamental human rights that we have been deprived in Swaziland for more than 45 years.
African Union Chairman Musa Maman Faki has condemned the violence, called for peace. Others are calling for dialogue. But where do you see this ending in Eswatini?
We are in full support of what the African Union is saying. For starters, we fully and wholeheartedly condemn the violence that has been perpetrated by the king against an unarmed and peacefully protesting people of Swaziland that are claiming and are calling for their rights to be respected and for multi-party democracy to return to Swaziland. So it is the state that has unleashed the army on an unarmed and defenseless people.
Vusi Shongwe is the exiled leader of the Swaziland People's Liberation Movement. He spoke with me from Johannesburg, South Africa. And you are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, in the Central African Republic, the UN humanitarian coordinator is expressing concern about the rise in attacks on humanitarian workers in the country. Ms. Denise Brown says that they are neutral, adding that attacking them is criminal and harmful to the population. She also says the workers should be respected and protected. Her remarks come after local media report of a sharp rise in attacks of humanitarian workers. It also come after armed men attacked a Doctors Without Borders caretaker and three others in an ambush. Experts say the attacks could impede much-needed support to a population in need of help to survive. Ms. Denise Brown tells me that attacks on humanitarian workers in the Central African Republic and elsewhere are unacceptable.
So we've had a number of attacks on the population, which are being documented. And we've had a number of attacks against the humanitarian community, which are just completely unacceptable, to attack people who are coming to assist others by many different armed actors. So, you know, we went up to almost 230 incidents over the past 5 months alone, which is, I think, it's about almost 60% higher than the same period last year. So while we're trying to deliver humanitarian life-saving assistance, on a number of occasions, our colleagues are being, as last week, shot and killed. We've had a number of vehicles looted, both from the UN agencies and the international NGO community, while delivering assistance. We've had people looted in their homes. So, you know, we're doing our best, but we are neutral. We're impartial. We're not taking sides. We're not aligned to any party. We're here absolutely for the population. And the fact that our work is being obstructed, we need to speak out about it. And so our humanitarian team has been speaking out about the incidents which occur against the population, but which also occur against the group of people that try to deliver that assistance.
Ms. Brown, you talked about the assistance activities that you have been undertaking that are currently being obstructed. But what are some of the other difficulties that your organization, OCHA, is encountering?
You know, one of the biggest challenges we've had over the past 5 months was the blocking of the main supply road into the country, what we call here the MSR1. A couple of targeted attacks by the armed groups and the coalition of armed groups on that road really created a huge and perfectly understandable fear factor, so that the transporters didn't want to come across. You know, at one time there were over 1,000 trucks on the other side of the border in Cameroon, which included trucks for the humanitarian community, for the World Food Program, for UNICEF, for the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, for the international NGOs, and for MINUSCA, the UN peacekeeping operation here. And we started to see shortages of food in the market and up to increases of 60%. So there was a deliberate attempt to choke the capital and create food shortages and panic. So that was really one of the major obstructions we've had to deal with. The second we're dealing with right now is during these offensive and counteroffensive, we have people who are caught in the middle, you know, ordinary people, people who live in small villages, who work on their land, who try and send their children to school, and then end up having to flee their homes out of fear of an attack and what might happen to them.
There are concerns among some of the affected population who you provide assistance to that because of some of these gross security challenges, they have fear that humanitarian organizations like yours could park and leave. How do you address some of these concerns for them?
We are doing our utmost to stay and deliver. Both the UN agencies and the international NGOs who manage to deliver assistance to about 1 million people a month in this country, despite all the difficulties. So while yes, the incident last week with MSF has shaken us up, it has really shaken us up. We will work on these issues. We will continue to pass the messages that we are neutral, we are impartial, we are delivering assistance. There's no reason, we are not part of this conflict. There is no reason to target humanitarian aid workers. At the end, it's only the population that suffers. So my message to the population of the Central African Republic, who know us very well, is we'll continue to do our best to remain, but we also need armed actors to respect humanitarian principles and allow us to do our job.
Some also say that because of the murder of some of these humanitarian medical organizations like the MSF murder, there has to be a red line that need not to be crossed. Is there a red line that can be crossed that would significantly affect delivery of humanitarian assistance?
Killing medical personnel is a red line. It's definitely a red line. It means that delivering assistance, supporting people in those communities is going to be practically impossible in the coming days or weeks. It's very true. How can we send people in to assist the population with the risk of being shot and killed? That doesn't, however, mean that in other parts of the country where we can operate without that risk that we will stop. Absolutely not. You know, we understand that between the population and the humanitarian community, if we withdraw that humanitarian community, where will the population turn to? Yeah. So we are very mindful of our responsibility to the population, but I'm also a humanitarian coordinator, very responsible, very mindful of my responsibility to protect humanitarian aid workers. And yes, there are absolutely limits. There are definitely limits.
Ms. Denise Brown is the UN Humanitarian Coordinator in the Central African Republic, or CAR. He spoke with me from the capital, Bangui. In Nigeria, the World Igbo Congress, a socio-political organization, is calling on the government to ensure the protection of the rights of Nnamdi Kanu, leader of the separatist group Indigenous People of Biafra, or IPOB. The separatist leader was recently arrested after jumping bail in 2017 and leaving the country. Information Minister Lai Mohammed says state intelligence operatives followed Kanu's trail for 2 years before the arrest. Speaking to the local media, the information minister says the separatist leader was living luxuriously while on the run. Nnamdi Kanu has been leading demands for people of Igbo ethnicities to secede from Nigeria to establish a country to be called Biafra. But in 2017, the government designated IPOB as a terrorist organization. Local media reports members of the group attacked police sessions, but the group denies it. Anthony Ejiofor is the chairman of the World Igbo Congress. He tells me that his group is calling on the international community to ensure due process is followed, arguing that there is lack of trust that the government will respect the rights of Nnamdi Kanu.
We do not have faith in the justice system in Nigeria. That is why we are worried about the safety of Nnamdi. And we want a civilized world to be aware of that situation, where the convention for extradition is observed. In this particular case, we did not see extradition. The style with which they brought him to Nigeria is suspect. We think it is something we have called international gangsterism. And because of that, these fellows don't respect the rule of law. And that is why we think the international community should be aware of this and help to make sure that Nnamdi Kanu is safe.
Some people are expressing concern that he will have his day in court. So the World Igbo Congress is making a mountain out of a molehill when they know very well that Nnamdi Kanu is going to have his day in court. The court process is proceeding smoothly. So there's nothing to worry about. How do you respond to that?
I would take it with a pinch of salt when you said the court process is proceeding very smoothly. We don't have faith or confidence in even the judicial system. I'll give you an example of one kind of somersault in the Nigerian judicial system. A state in Igbo land, there was a runoff election. Suddenly, an individual who was fourth in position in terms of the number of votes he had, the court in Nigeria made him number one, and he is now governor of that state. Is that a judicial system you can have confidence in? When it comes to issues concerning the Igbo people, they had never received justice, and therefore we think that the international community should be aware of this and help us make sure that the court system, like you said, will run smoothly. We want it to run smoothly. And I believe there will be Nnamdi Kanu's team of lawyers will be there, and we hope there will be no somersault of any sort.
Nnamdi Kanu has been a thorn in the flesh of the Nigerian authorities. He's created so much instability in Igbo land, and that he recently ordered for the murder of or the attack of police stations that led to the killing of police officers who have family, who have children, and that he should be dealt with in accordance with the full force of the law.
No, I don't agree. I do not agree that Nnamdi Kanu issued order that led to the killing of police people and so on. There's something they call unknown gunmen. And we are aware of the fact that these unknown gunmen are essentially some of those people I spoke about earlier, those marauders, the Fulani herdsmen who were brought into Nigeria through their open border policy. And they all flooded into Nigeria and now are soldiers and policemen flooding the entire southeastern Nigeria. They do things and they are put on Nnamdi Kanu and IPOB and ESN. These are not responsible for that. The actual killing of people, the actual burning of government institutions are carried out by these unknown gunmen. A lot of the people who are in Nigeria are afraid of government, and this is why they don't speak out.
Critics of the World Igbo Congress are saying that in spite of the inflammatory statements that Nnamdi Kanu has made, that seeks to undermine the territorial integrity of Nigeria by calling on Igbos to pick up arms and demand cessation. The World Igbo Congress, they argue, has yet to condemn his actions against Nigerian as a state. How do you respond to that?
World Igbo Congress is completely not in support of violence. And but what we are saying is that in even where there is no violence, there is inalienable right of a people to self-determination. It is guaranteed by the Convention of the United Nations. And therefore, that is where we stand. If there's any action that can be attributed to Nnamdi Kanu, we are not in support of violence, and we do not think that Nnamdi Kanu is actually in support of violence. He may have said a thing or two by way of youthful exuberance, but he still is fighting for the inalienable right of Igbo people to self-determination, which is guaranteed of all for all indigenous people of this world by the 2007 Convention of the United Nations.
Anthony Ejiofor is the chairman of the World Igbo Congress. He spoke with me from Houston, Texas. The World Bank says Kenya's gross domestic product, or GDP, is expected to grow by 4.5% in 2021, signaling a partial recovery from COVID-19 pandemic. Our viewer Ruben Chiama reports from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
In its latest report, the international lender says economic activity in East Africa's largest economy is likely to accelerate to above 5% on average in 2022 and 2023. Keith Hansen is the World Bank Country Director for Kenya.
However, the recovery is a partial one, and the pandemic is clearly still heavily affecting some sectors as well as overall economic performance. So the outlook very much hinges on how the vaccination effort progresses and on the overall course of the pandemic, both in Kenya and globally, which of course no one can confidently predict yet. We're still in a very fluid situation, and this is in large part due to the large gaps in vaccination coverage across countries.
The prospects for Kenya's continuing recovery, which is uneven across sectors, hinge on the progress of the vaccination effort against COVID-19. Albert Mwenda is the Director General of Budget, Fiscal and Economic Affairs at the National Treasury.
The Kenyan economy, however, we think has remained fairly resilient prior to the outbreak. But during the times of the pandemic, the growth has been affected. Kenya, like other countries in the region, had their businesses disrupted, leading to closure of businesses and jobs. And that's why this discussion today is important. Sectors like tourism, trade, transport, education, manufacturing, among others, have suffered.
According to the report titled Kenya Economic Update, Rising Above the Waves, consumption is expected to strengthen. It will likely be supported by a recovery in wages and household incomes and strong remittances. However, many services face a longer path to recovery. It could be weakened by the slow deployment of vaccines due to supply challenges, logistical impediments to domestic distribution, and vaccine hesitancy. Alex Sinat is a senior economist at the World Bank and a co-author of the report.
Fortunately, agriculture, in fact, has been having a rather good performance, which has been a major contributor to Kenya's overall output actually remaining a lot firmer than in Sydney and many other countries. Secondary sector, however, which is manufacturing, construction, general industry, was hit harder, a small contraction in the second quarter of last year, but then recovering, it seems, actually fairly quickly in the third quarter of last year. So we would describe that as a pretty resilient performance in a lot of ways.
Furthermore, external factors such as setbacks to the global economy due to a resurgence in infection rates could adversely impact the projected recovery in Kenya's goods exports, tourism, and capital inflows. The report also provided an update on the labor market in Kenya as the country moves into a crucial period of its demographic transition. Hansen gave more details.
Over the next decade, Kenya's largest youth cohort in history is going to attain working age, with about 1 million people starting to search for jobs each year.
He says this creates the opportunity for growth, but only if the economy can create high-quality jobs to match the large number of people entering the workforce. Observers hope job creation will be enhanced with a successful strategy to curb or eliminate COVID-19, which had caused the loss of thousands of jobs over the past 2 years. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
And right now it's time for music from our African collection.
Sina chambi no me ni kata. Weza koro, oh, oh. giza udaku wameweka nuta. Sina uzima sito boy, unitaki katu na mchanga umekuta. Umeweka dhima niko boy, utaki mithubutu umeweka tuta. Yamezizima sito moro, kisu changu kutu nyama inajivuta. Vuta, umeondoka bila kusema sababu ilo kufanya uende. Ungeandika tabarua ningisoma nitake ama nisipende. Hata kama umenichoka ya nyuma ungevuta taswira. Tumetoka ni kwa jomeweza kuzira. Kuzira. Ifi kweli dali, unanipa maumivu mpaka. Oh dali, wili utakonda nitachaka. Hafla na kumbuka mbali, umekosa uvumilivu hata. Au penzi lako ghali, pengine sina chambi ndo menikata. Weza koro.
We are
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Bill Eagle, reporter Douglas Impuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, a lounging lizard catches no crickets. I'm your host, Peter Clotet, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.